Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do top-down solutions to our most intractable social, political, and practical challenges compare with those that rely on diverse and decentralized contributions? While eureka moments make for good stories, my guest today would remind us of the many positive changes in the world, from the decline in U.S. smoking rates to the streamlining of the patent review process, that are linked to networked systems of information and the accumulation of incremental improvements. So what gives networks an advantage over centralized planning and command structures, and how can innovators harness those advantages? Journalist Stephen Johnson joins us to talk about that. He's a contributor to Time, Wired, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal, and he has a new book out called Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked World. Stephen, welcome back to Think.
Hey, Chris, it's great to be back.
You start the book with encouraging and, to your mind, underreported statistics on airline safety. At this point, American kids are more likely to grow up to be president than to be killed in a commercial jet crash.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, when I was growing up, you know, airline safety was incredibly safe, and you would always hear the, you know, studies about how you were safer to fly than you were to drive in a car and so on. But since that point, it's gotten, you know, remarkably safer. And in fact, you know, we've had this stretch that I wrote about in the book where there were these two consecutive years where there were no commercial air fatalities for the first time in the history of the modern aviation system. And, you know, it's one of these things where that is the real news, right? I mean, mm-hmm. The fact that every single day there are all these planes flying around and it's just amazingly safe and reliable. And, you know, and yet what we tend to focus on, for understandable reasons, I think, you know, are the occasion, you know, the outliers when a plane goes down. But it's kind of a strange bias that's in the media system where we focus on the kind of catastrophic things rather than the stories of slow and incremental progress, which is, in fact, how progress happens most of the time.
So you had written about this phenomenon for a web publication, and like hours later, these headlines come out about this U.S. Airlines accident on the Hudson, and a lot of people remember that Sully Sullenberger was sort of named as the hero. But ultimately, you found that sort of proves your theory about incremental change and a network of different sources to make things better. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, it was a very bizarre story. As you said, when this news broke about the 2-year period where there have been no commercial fatalities, I thought, well, this is great. This is the kind of story we need to emphasize more. So I put up, I was writing for the wonderful blog Boing Boing, and so I put up this post about it. And within minutes of posting this thing, I start to get all these emails and texts from people saying, Stephen, there is a plane that just crash landed in the Hudson. You know, your hubristic aviation safety has, you know, you've challenged the gods and they've sent this plane down. And, I mean, it didn't seem funny at all because at the time,
right,
you know, we didn't know that everyone was going to survive. But then, of course, it turned out that everyone did survive. And, in fact, you know, what it seemed initially to be a kind of rebuke to my optimism about aviation safety turned out to be actually an endorsement of the premise. And what I tried to say in the book is that, you know, it was interesting to watch the response to it because people called it the miracle on the Hudson, and there was so much focus on Sully, the hero pilot, which, by the way, he deserves. I mean, it was an amazing feat of aviation skill. But it was also crucial, the kind of longer story of collaboration and kind of idea sharing that helped build the plane that he was flying. Because a big part of it is that the plane performed beautifully as well. So the first part of it is that the engines didn't explode, right? They could have, you know, taken in those birds, or a lot of birds that hit those jet engines, and they could have, you know, shattered, and then, you know, everyone would have perished almost instantly. And it's partially because, interestingly, the government sits and tests every commercial jet engine, every model of commercial jet engine, by throwing frozen bird carcasses, chicken carcasses, with this device they call the chicken gun, to test whether they won't just kind of splinter and fragment and bring down a whole plane. And then the plane, the Airbus that he was flying, also uses this amazing fly-by-wire system that is very advanced kind of electronics, partially developed by the government and by NASA, and then integrated into the Airbus 320, which gave Sully a lot of assistance in landing the plane successfully. So he had this kind of decades of kind of collective intelligence that had been refining this electronic system that helped him steer the plane with very little power in the engines to a safe landing. So, you know, we need to tell the story of safety as the story of progress, and we need to tell the story also of all that collaboration that made that great success story possible. And if we don't tell that part of the story, then we misunderstand, you know, where progress actually comes from.
And it's funny, we had Sully on the show, and he was a lovely guy, and he would be the first one to jump on the bandwagon with you. He was very humble and insistent that it wasn't just him, that it had a lot to do with years of preparation and training and safety advances. It's funny that the people who are sort of made the Eureka story are the ones who best are in a position to understand all the incremental progress.
Yeah, and it's part of our, you know, it's part of our responsibility in the media to try and figure out ways to tell those more complicated, collaborative kind of network stories.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's always easier to say, there was a superhero, you know, here he is, look at him, put him on the cover. And it's harder to say, well, actually, thousands of people contributed to this success. Just as it's easier to say, look at this terrible, catastrophic thing that happened, instead of saying, like, well, this one part of society got 2% better this year as it has for the last 50 years.
Right. Which is not sexy, but is awesome.
It's not sexy, but it is awesome. It's not sexy, but awesome. That's a good motto. But it, you know, in some ways, so many of the things that we celebrate that make our lives, you know, kind of nice ones came out of that incremental progress. And so, you know, we have to figure it a way as journalists and as commentators and things like that to make sure that we tell those stories too.
Well, you know, it is an interesting critique of journalism because a lot of the things that were true headlines, say, 20 years ago are not true anymore. Things like, you know, unintended pregnancy, people think that those rates are still rising, they're going down. Divorce rates have fallen, infant mortality has fallen. A lot of the ills in our society have actually been improved upon.
Yeah, we are, you know, we have economic issues right now, for sure. But in terms of what you might call the social health of society, both the physical health and the kind of societal health, whether it's, you know, teenage pregnancies, drug use, even education scores, and certainly everything related to violence, all of those trend lines over the last 20 years are very positive. Some of them are extraordinary. I mean, we've seen this kind of 60-70% drop in crime over the last 15 or 20 years. And the amazing thing about it, actually, the crime stuff has been reported, but despite the fact that it's reported, people don't seem to be listening. One of the most amazing things that I found in researching this book is that Gallup has done these polls every year to ask American people, do they think crime is getting better or worse? And every year for the last, you know, 5 or 6 years, they've said it's worse this year than it was the year before. It's getting worse and worse.
Hmm.
And so here you have really arguably the most extraordinary kind of dramatic improvement in society at large in the United States, the tremendous improvement in all sorts of crime, violent crime, petty crime, sexual assault, all the main categories of crime have dramatically improved over the last 10 or 15 years. And nobody believes it. You know, people are just like, no, it's worse. It was much safer 15 years ago. And they're wrong. They're absolutely wrong.
Okay, so let's talk about two different ways for organizing systems that play into all of this. What is the difference between a Legrand star and a barren web?
Right. So, you know, this book is in some ways, it's my first kind of political book. It's writing about a vision of how to make the world a better place and how it should happen. But, you know, I like to tell stories. I didn't want it to just be a kind of a book of political theory. And so it, as a way of kind of conceptualizing this, in the book I tell these two stories, one of which is about the French railway system in the 19th century. So the French had this funny thing where they built this elaborate kind of state-of-the-art canal system between about 1780 and 1820, 25, or something like that. It was this beautiful, incredible engineering project, and by the time it was done, it was almost exactly when the railroads were taking off in the rest of Europe. So this amazing system was kind of obsolete on delivery. They were like, oh, wait, we need a rail system. And so they set about to create the world's greatest, you know, most beautiful and most efficient railway system. And they, one of the guys who was doing it, his name was Legrand, and so it kind of partially became named after him. And they built a very centralized system. It was a classic this is a classic kind of French system in the sense that Paris was at the center of everything. Mm-hmm. And it forms this kind of very geometric star. So all the rail lines go off in these very kind of linear kind of spokes off the main center in Paris. And it's kind of beautiful. It's symmetrical. It gets rid of all the kind of local variations of topography and where the towns are and the rivers. And just it looks great from above.
Yeah, like from the 60,000-foot view, that would seem to be the most efficient way to do things.
And they thought it was like, oh, great, everyone will shuttle right into the, you know, metropolis at the center, and, you know, this will be fantastic. The problem was that it didn't have a lot of kind of what we would now call redundancy. Everything had to move through the center. It was very centralized in this way. And it turned out next door, the kind of Prussian-German system was much more chaotic. It wasn't planned in a centralized way, and it was this kind of loose network that looked much more kind of jumbled from above. But it ended up being a more efficient system because there were multiple routes to get from point A to point B. And so you didn't have everything kind of clogged in the center the way you did with the Le Grand Star. So that's one metaphor. That's kind of a metaphor for the way that states like to organize things. They like to create these big centralized structures where everything gets routed towards the headquarters of the government, to the bureaucrats, to the people in control of the system. The other example is the design of the Internet, mm-hmm. Which partially came from this guy, Paul Baran, who designed the kind of initial outline. The Internet has many mothers and fathers, but Baran is certainly one of them. And he kind of came up with this idea of a decentralized system where there wouldn't be a central mainframe intelligence computer that was controlling everything, that as we now say, the intelligence and the network lived at the edges of the network and all the little computers that were connected to it. And this, you know, this is the foundation of the Internet. It then became the kind of foundation of the way that the web was organized. And it's one of the most profound ideas of the last 50 years, I think. And so in the book, I kind of say, look, there's the Legrand star, super centralized, and then there's the Baran web, which is distributed, decentralized, and diverse. And that's the kind of organizational structure that I really talk about a lot in the book.
And the reason that a web structure is so much more robust is that even if you have catastrophic failure in one segment of one section, the rest can function pretty well and, in fact, take up some of the slack.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. And then there's another side, which is not so much exactly in terms of the way that information moves through the Internet, but on a technical level, but more about the way that information moves through these networks in general, which is to say, when you have a center, when you have, let's say you have a system where you've got like a government, where you've got a lot of people in, you know, in the state capital who are trying to, you know, plan something in society. Well, the problem, and this is something that the Austrian economist Hayek observed many years ago, the problem is that the world is very complex and there's so much going on. It's very hard for a small number of people at the center to understand the system enough to be able to plan it effectively. We can continue on this after the break.
Great. Thank you for setting that up. Journalist Stephen Johnson is here. His new book is called Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked World. If you want to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Stephen Johnson. He writes for Time Magazine, Wired, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal, and he's got a new book out called Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked World. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. So, Stephen, before the break, you were talking about centralized command structures not necessarily being able to respond appropriately to the complexities of the real world.
Yeah, and that is the argument that kind of the traditional libertarian argument for why markets outperform governments, because the market is a distributed, decentralized system. No one in the market understands the full state of the market, but because everyone is kind of focused on their little piece of it, the market is able to kind of innovate and solve problems in all these creative ways. So there's kind of this information bottleneck that happens in states. The world is too hard to understand with a small group of people trying to understand the whole thing. So, and this is one of these things that I think is absolutely true, and it's an important contribution to our understanding of how societies work. The problem is that the marketplace and the private sector doesn't solve all our problems on its own. And so what a number of us have started to think, and what the book is really a celebration of, is that it's possible to build these kinds of peer networks, as I call them, that are equally decentralized but aren't necessarily markets. And they distribute the kind of intelligence to the edges of the network in a really smart way. So let me give you, just so we don't get too abstract, I'll give you a great example of this. There's a wonderful service probably in Dallas, I think, 311, which is a number of cities around the country. New York has kind of the most advanced version of it. And 311 is a service where anybody can dial three numbers on a phone and they can get city information. They can find out what's happening in their neighborhood. They can find out if it's schools are closed, et cetera. They get to a live human being who can tell them all this stuff. But most importantly, they can report problems. So if there's a pothole on their street, if there's a bar that's making too much noise down the street, if they need something, a service in their neighborhood, they call 311. And the city takes in all this information, and it uses it to map and locate, you know, emerging problems or needs in a city of 8 million people, which is a huge information overload problem. Talk about an information bottleneck.
Right.
And so what they've done is they've basically taken all these people who aren't on the payroll of the government, who aren't bureaucrats, who aren't working inside the command center of the city government, and said, if you can dial three numbers on a phone, you can be part of this process of helping us make this city a better place. And it's been a huge success. I mean, it's just, you know, it's been really, really popular, and it's helped the city govern the city much better, and it's helped people feel like they can participate in this new way. And it involves some technology, but it barely uses the internet. It's actually really just, you know, talking to these call centers on a phone. So there's lots more to be done in that vein.
And the beauty of a system like that, and you have a great example of this, is that it has proven to be able to solve problems that it was not even designed specifically to handle.
Yeah, so I'll tell you, this is something I actually experienced firsthand. There was this very bizarre thing that happened about 5 or 6 years ago in New York, where these neighborhoods would start to, strangely enough, would start to smell like maple syrup. Generally on the west side of the city, so you'd be walking around, and I experienced this once myself personally. You'd be walking, you know, through the West Village or something, and all of a sudden you'd be like, pancakes! It smells like pancakes everywhere.
Where Mayor Bloomberg would put a stop to that.
And so this was, you know, this was post 9/11 New York, and so yeah, people were on edge, and so they were afraid, you know, this is weird smell, maybe it's some kind of chemical attack from like the Aunt Jemima wing of Al-Qaeda or something. And so they call into 311, which had just started at this point, and they're like, you know, it smells like syrup weirdly in Chelsea. And the city, you know, sent out, they didn't have an explanation for it, so they sent out people to detect, you know, if there were any weird particles in the air, and it was fine. So they instructed the 311 operators to, you know, just let everyone know it was fine. They should just enjoy the smell. And then it kept happening, and it kept happening for years, and the Times wrote about it, bloggers wrote about it. And finally, the city said, wait a second, all these calls that are coming in, these are clues. They can help us figure out this mystery, because we know when they called and where they called from. We've got this data. And so they created these maps. They took the data of where the calls had come from each time one of these things had happened, and they looked at the weather patterns, particularly the wind patterns, And when you analyzed all that data together, it created this very clear line pointing back to this very precise point in New Jersey across the Hudson. And they literally kind of drove a man, you know, over the bridge to this point. And what they found there was this kind of flavor and smell additive plant, which was every now and then processing this fenugreek seed, which is used in cheap maple syrup, syrup knockoffs. And so they'd solved this mystery. Now, it wasn't a chemical attack. It wasn't a life-or-death matter. But as you said, when they were designing the system, no one said, oh, this will be great when their syrup smells in New York. We'll be able to figure out where they're coming from. But because it was diverse and decentralized in the kinds of information and the people it was getting the information from, the people were able to detect these new kinds of problems. And using the data, the city was able to use that information to kind of untangle the mystery.
So you've described this as somewhat as your first political book, but I want to talk about your use of the word progressive, because in the context in which you use it, it doesn't necessarily mean progressive as in only liberal and not conservative. Talk about how you define the word.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what to call this movement. And early on, I realized that the word peer was a beautiful word because it was in the technology. We call them peer-to-peer networks. And it's also a lovely word. You know, your peers, a jury of your peers, a respect to your peers. It was just a word that worked really well. But I also wanted to attach it to some kind of existing political tradition as well. And so ultimately I kind of decided to talk about these folks as peer progressives. The strange thing about it is that, in my experience, I mean, I've always kind of called myself a progressive, but the reason I got attracted to that worldview is because I believed in progress. You know, I was amazed at all the progress that had happened, you know, in my lifetime or the last 100, 200 years. I've written a lot of books kind of celebrating that progress, whether it's in 19th century Europe and 18th century England or 21st century Silicon Valley. But the odd thing was when I talked to a lot of my fellow progressives, other political people who call themselves progressives, they never talked about progress. In fact, they were the most depressed people that I talked to. You know, they were the ones who were like, the planet is going to be destroyed, we're going to have a population bomb, whenever, you know, they had the bleakest vision of where we were heading as a species of anyone on the political spectrum. And so I was trying to kind of, By calling these folks peer progressives, to suggest that there was a slightly different flavor here. These were folks who believed in the story of progress, believed that they were optimistic. They believed that actually things were getting better and we had a lot of tools that were going to enable us to make things even better. And they believed that this peer network structure was going to be one of those key resources in making that future possible. But it doesn't exactly map on to the kind of progressive tradition the way we talk about it normally.
So let's talk about Kickstarter. This is an arts funding, organization, if that's not exactly the right word. But it's interesting because you talk about the relative failures of a government-sponsored group like the NEA and the relative failures of the market to ensure that there's adequate funding for all kinds of artists to be doing their work.
Yeah, this is a great example of kind of a hole in the market. Most of us, not everyone, but most of us have come to the conclusion that that it's good for society to fund more experimental creative ideas that haven't yet found a following in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, in the book I say, you know, we have a National Endowment for the Arts. We don't have a National Endowment for detergents because the market is very good on its own at, you know, creating detergents. We don't need that kind of subsidy. But so we have big government organizations like the National Endowment for the Arts, and we have, in a sense, big capital philanthropic organizations like the Duke Foundation and the MacArthur Foundation that are funded by people who made billions of dollars through capitalism, right? And until very recently, if you were an artist who was trying to do something that was kind of on the edges of, you know, experimental ideas, and you couldn't, you know, get a record deal to finish your album, or you couldn't get enough funding to finish your art installation and so on, you either had to go to one of those big philanthropic organizations or one of those big government institutions. And those were your choices.
Mm-hmm.
And what this Kickstarter service ended up saying is, they said, well, listen, you know, the world is filled with people who are willing to give, you know, $50 or $10 to support something that they think is interesting just for the love of it. I mean, you know, you can give the money, and you can get, with Kickstarter, you can get little rewards for participating. You're not an investor. You can't kind of profit from the money you've contributed, but, you know, you'll get invited to a CD party, or, you know, someone, if you give $100, they'll come and serenade you outside your window. Whatever you, they can set up whatever rewards that they want if you support their project. And it's one of those amazing things where, you know, it's like Wikipedia. If you heard about it before it started, you would say, well, that's a lovely idea. That will never work in practice.
Right.
And then it turns out Kickstarter is on track now to distribute more money to creative people than the entire National Endowment of the Arts. And it's only like 3 or 4 years old. So that is a, you know, a beautiful kind of peer network-like structure where you've greatly diversified the number of people who are kind of contributing and helping out with this process of making interesting creative work. Now, the funny thing about Kickstarter is that it's actually a for-profit company. I mean, they take a tiny little slice out of the out of each transaction, and they're probably going to do, you know, it's a venture-backed, you know, technology startup. But what it creates is this kind of gift economy where people are giving other people dollars without getting something back in the normal way. You know, when someone contributes $100 to making a music video, they're not paying for it, and no music video is worth $100. But they want to share and they want to help out, and so it creates this kind of different kind of economy within this startup vehicle. And it's just an amazing success story.
We have an email here from Kent in Duncanville who says, have you ever applied these ideas to healthcare? Many people say a single-payer centralized system would be more efficient. What do you think of that?
Well, here's one example from the book where I have thought this through a little bit. And it has to do with a huge part of the healthcare problem we have now, which is the cost of prescription drugs. So we have this interesting system in this country where when a drug company develops a new drug, we give them this patent on the drug, which gives them basically an exclusive monopoly on manufacturing it for a certain amount of time, 5 years or whatever it turns out to be. And it's one of these interesting things where the state has to intervene in the market to say, no one else can manufacture this drug, so that you can make as much money as you possibly can for the next 5 years to recoup your costs in producing and doing all the research that led to that drug. So we actually are kind of interfering with natural market forces, which makes non-generic drugs incredibly expensive, right? Mm-hmm. So they raise the entire cost of healthcare for everyone because you have to pay for all these expensive drugs. So what some people have started to propose is to say, wait, hold on, now what if we, instead of issuing these exclusive patents, what if we set up basically what they call prize-backed challenges, where we say if somebody comes up with a drug to solve this problem, some combination of the insurance industry and the government will reward that company with a huge prize, like a $1 billion prize, that they will immediately get for having solved this problem. And the only caveat is that they will have to immediately sell their drug at generic prices, and anybody else can be free to kind of develop their own generics and improve on the model that the company had. So you get the reward, but and so you're incentivized to spend the research and development money to kind of develop the new drug. But when the drug actually appears on the market, it's much cheaper and far more people can have access to it and healthcare costs go down. And that prize mechanism is actually, there's a very long history of these prizes. A huge part of the Enlightenment actually was driven by prizes that were set by organizations like the Royal Society in England. So it's a tradition that actually has worked you know, thousands and thousands of times in the past, and I think there's an opportunity to apply that to problems in healthcare and other parts of society today.
What's also so interesting about the prize setup is that you can bring people in who wouldn't necessarily sort of reach the bar of employment for a particular lab or something, who might in fact have the skills and the knowledge and the time and effort and tenacity to develop something that works.
Well, you know, I bet a lot of your listeners read that wonderful book, Longitude, about the Longitude Prize, you know, a couple hundred years ago. And that's exactly what that was an example that what's his name, John Harrison, who came up with that, was not one of the, you know, elites in England at the time. He was, you know, this kind of carpenter, watchmaker kind of guy who was on the outside, but he had this brilliant idea. And because there was this open competition, it incentivized him to go and try and win it, and it gave him a vehicle for getting his idea into circulation. And ultimately, you know, after probably too long, he did eventually, you know, kind of win the prize. And that's the power of these systems. Again, it's where we started. It's the idea that, you know, the more people you bring into the process, and the more diversity of perspectives and fields of expertise that you bring into these kind of problem-solving situations, the more likely you are to innovate and come up with better solutions.
Not surprisingly, Stephen, people in our business, the media business, have done a lot of worrying about the introduction of sort of a bully pulpit to people who don't have the right credentials. You argue here, though, and it's really interesting to me, that in fact news, political news gathering at least, is more robust today than ever.
Well, yeah, there are two sides to this. The first is, it is undeniably true that when you extend the number of people participating in any process, and when you diversify the perspectives, one of the things that you introduce is noise, error, people with an axe to grind, crazy people. and so all the systems that I look in the book have very important and varied forms of kind of filtering and allowing the best ideas to kind of rise to the top and kind of tamping down the less good ideas. Kickstarter, for instance, less than 50% of the projects on Kickstarter get funded. And that's a sign of the success. But then there's another point, which I will also make after the commercial break.
Thanks again.
I'm good at this.
Stephen Johnson is with us. We're talking about his new book, Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked World. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can email think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Stephen Johnson, who writes for The Wall Street Journal, Wired, Time, and The New York Times, and is author of the new book Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked World. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. Before the break, Stephen, you were going to tell us about some of the ways that we can filter out the noise of these peer-distributed networks.
Yeah, all of these systems have to have some way for, in a sense, some kind of value to be assigned to the various different contributions that people are making. In a sense, the great example of this is Google. This is the beauty of the Google algorithm many, many years ago, as they said, oh, when somebody links to a page, that's a sign that there's something valuable on that page. So pages with more links become more highly ranked, and that's where Google became a billion-dollar company, is through that way of kind of assigning value in a distributed, decentralized way to the entire internet. With media and with journalism, one of the points I'm trying to make in the book is, you know, we have to remember, again, it's that kind of 20-year story of progress. We have to remember what it was like before these new disruptive forms came along. And one analogy I have, or example I have, is thinking about the election. So the first really important election in my life that I followed intensely was the 92 Clinton election that Clinton won. And if you compare the kind of information resources that I had available to me then following that election, which I read everything I could about it, I watched all the TV shows, I tried to keep up with it in every way, it is amazing how much more information I have now, and even had in the 2008 election. you know, almost all the institutions are still around. The big newspapers are still around. The news magazines are still around. And they're generating really as much news as ever for the most part, and the wonderful radio stations that are covering it. But think about all the additional stuff, not just the bloggers, but the academics who now have a forum where they can weigh in on economic issues without publishing for a heavily academic environment, the stats nerds who, you know, like Nate Silver, that would go through all the details on all the campaigns, the direct access to the candidates themselves. I mean, I talk about like how many people watched the full version of Obama's Philadelphia speech in 2008. Hmm. You would have, I mean, the number of people would, you know, it was millions and millions of people watched that because it was available on YouTube, but it would have, you know, been seen by a tiny fraction of that in 1992, just because, you know, no network would have aired it in its entirety, other than maybe CNN, which was, you know, very small at that point. So there's just so much more information out there. Yes, it is noisier, and there are people out there you disagree with, but the resources are really quite extraordinary. And so I see that as progress. And, you know, it's not unlike the argument that people made against democracy as a political system, right? I mean, people still say when you open it up to the entire country voting, there's all these crazy people who vote, and it's true. I mean, it's undeniably true. You would have less noise if you just had the elites making the decisions. But we've decided, and we have a lot of evidence that shows that the kind of diversity of perspectives that come in a democracy when you set up the system in the right way will, in the long run, outperform the more centralized versions with the smaller group that are making all the decisions. And I think that's going to be true of media as well.
So what are the implications of all of this for the way we do democracy, the way we decide to spend public funds, all of that?
I'm really interested. I think this the kind of peer progressive movement is, other than the kind of technology space, its first great foothold is local communities. And that's why 311 is such an important example. But it doesn't have to involve technology. In fact, there's a wonderful kind of technique that was pioneered in Brazil like 30 years ago called participatory budgeting. And it's a system where, you know, a certain block of the taxpayer dollars every year is kind of allocated for the communities themselves to decide where to spend it. And so these neighborhoods get together and they say, okay, well, the school needs a new, you know, science center, or we need sewer repair, or we want to build this little public garden. And they kind of rank all these priorities, and then they kind of debate them and propose different solutions to the problems they've cited. And then they divvy up the money based on those decisions. And it's had this, and this kind of approach is actually spreading around the world. More than 10% of European cities now use it, and it's coming to the United States as well. And what it does is it does two things. One, it greatly reduces the corruption and kind of fraud and waste, because people are like, hey, we decided on that sewer system last year.
Where is it?
Where is it? You know, whereas when it's some plan that somebody else came up with, you don't really notice that it hasn't been built yet and the money's been spent on somebody's, you know, pool. So, but the other thing it adds is that it creates a sense that, you know, we're building this community, this neighborhood together. We're actually making these decisions, and that you can get involved and you can see the results. You can see how your neighborhood got better because of these decisions that you helped participate in. And that just adds to the kind of the civic, you know, identity of the community. Now, what I love about it is it's not that the private sector is doing it, because they're spending taxpayer dollars. Mm-hmm. But it's not a traditional kind of government program where the people in City Hall make the decisions, and, you know, it's very bottom up at the same time. And it actually really didn't involve that much technology, particularly when it started in Brazil. I mean, this was started well before the web became a popular medium. You know, it started in like 1989 and 1990, and it's worked extremely well there.
And I love the idea, because we all know there are neighborhoods where, you know, putting nice planters in the intersections would be really important to people. And there are other places where they say, absolutely not. We want to make sure that there are streetlights on every single corner.
Well, you know, the beautiful thing about local communities is, you know, unlike maybe the the political bloggers in their pajamas and all that kind of stuff. When you're talking about local communities, the experts are by definition the people who live in those neighborhoods,
sure.
Right? And so if you give those folks tools, and there are a lot of interesting both startups and nonprofit kind of startups that are working in this space right now. There's one called Neighborland. There's one called Neighborly. C-Click Fix. Just wonderful innovation happening in this space. And they're all about giving folks in communities the power to make their spaces better and more adaptive to their particular needs. And I just, you know, I look at those things and I say, great things are happening, and we should be celebrating those stories too.
So because you are speaking on an NPR station, I want to talk a little bit about the writing that you do here about the NPR fundraising model.
Yeah, well, I was trying to point out in Kickstarter that that the idea of small donors contributing to a worthwhile project, which, by the way, I think NPR is, is not something totally new, and it's in fact something that we saw a lot of in the Howard Dean campaign in 2004, and then in the Obama campaign in 2008, that they had these kind of small donors who were supporting their campaigns. But the difference with Kickstarter is that you're not kind of supporting an entire campaign generally, or a single candidate generally, or a single kind of station or network of stations.
It's project by project.
You're going after individual creators, individual projects, and that adds to the that in a sense adds another layer of network to it. So you, in a sense, you have a much wider network of potential projects to fund that are then being funded by a much wider network of potential funders.
Which is kind of the way ProPublica is doing it.
Yeah. So they're an example of a kind of news organization. I think we're going to see a lot of folks out there as journalists and reporters who, say, listen, I'm going to go and do a big investigative report on this corruption in City Hall around this particular topic, and I'm going to need $25,000 to do it because it's going to be 3-month investigation. It's going to take some time, and I'm not going to be able to focus on too many other things during that time. And they'll get backers to kind of support them through Kickstarter-like mechanisms. Some of those backers might be organizations. Some of those backers might be individuals. They might do kind of deals where, a newspaper gets the initial look at it to run it, and thus they pay for some of the reporting. But there's just a lot more options of ways to fund things today. We're still figuring it all out, and so what we're seeing right now is this process where the old institutions are having to reinvent their business models, and newspapers don't have a local monopoly on advertising the way they had for so long, and so they're being forced to rethink how their newsrooms work in a lot of ways. And it happens to be all happening in the midst of this terrible economic crisis. So,
yeah.
It was unfortunate historically that those two things, a long-term trend towards new business models for news and a short-term economic collapse, that those things happened to coincide. But I think in the long run, we're going to see a healthier flow of information and thanks to this kind of networking.
Well, the book gave me a lot to think about, and I was thinking about, the implications for long-form publishing, like a nonfiction book like Future Perfect. I mean, theoretically, one could foresee a time where you could raise money, say, this is how much I need or want to make in order to produce this book, and then suddenly the book is available, on demand for free to people. But I wonder, that works for you now because you're well-established and you've published a number of books. But what happens to the new sort of emergent voices that don't have a following yet?
Well, I don't have the stats right in front of me, but, Amazon is always talking about the incredible number of self-published authors that are in the best-selling list at the Kindle store. 50 Shades of Grey being the biggest example, which maybe not the best example, but what they are seeing, having created basically a publishing platform where anybody can come and say, hey, I've got a book and I'm going to price it however I want and I don't have a publisher and I'm just going to make it available to people as an ebook. What they're seeing is that, you know, the hundreds and thousands of up to now unpublished, unheard of authors are, you know, making in some cases some very good money and certainly making more money than they did before self-publishing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I would say in a funny way that that maybe it's the unpublished author that is better off in this new world because, you know, as established author, there's a lot of stuff that my publisher does for me and the kind of publicity department does for me, and I go on a big book tour, and there's all this stuff that's hard to arrange. And that, you know, it's really great to have a wonderful publisher like I do to help with all that stuff. And I wouldn't want to get rid of that. Whereas, you know, a young writer who basically just has a book and just wants readers, and who hasn't developed yet a relationship with a publisher, to be able to kind of get direct access to, you know, readers, millions of readers around the world thanks to something like Amazon, I think actually they're better off in a way than I would be in this new system.
Do you have a term that means the opposite of peer progressive?
That's a... I don't...
You can skip that. What happens...
I have to come up with one.
What happens to the people who are not ready to get on what seems to be quite a groundswell of new ways of doing things?
Well, the big thing I want to, you know, remind people of, to just at least as a basis, is that this kind of approach, the kind of peer network approach to building things, is fundamentally underlies the modern communications regime of our time. The internet was built with peer networks of people collaborating. The web was built with peer networks. A lot of the standards and software that we use on our Macs and on our Android phones came out of open source software, collaborative peer networks, building that stuff. So if you hear me kind of talking about these things and say, well, that sounds like some fantasy, you know, he's a utopian, that is lovely, you know, he should go teach a grad seminar somewhere. if that's what you hear, then just imagine if you could somehow magically turn off all the software that had been produced by peer networks on every computer in the world. What would happen to our society? Every single stock market would go down. Every single Mac, every single Android phone, every single iPad or iPhone would turn off. The internet would go off. The web would go off. Email would go off. It would be a catastrophe. It would be a World War scale catastrophe. And so in just 20 years, we have become dependent on these peer networks. So now what we have to figure out is, you know, what more can they do?
Stephen Johnson's new book is called Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked World. Stephen, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It was great to be back, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can find out about upcoming shows and download that podcast free every day at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.